This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Gene, An Intimate History by Siddhartha Mukherjee. Read by Dennis Boutsakaris.
An exact determination of the laws of heredity will probably work more change in man's outlook on the world and in his power over nature than any other advance in natural knowledge that can be foreseen. William Bateson. Human beings are ultimately nothing but carriers, passageways for genes. They ride us into the ground like racehorses from generation to generation. Genes don't think about what constitutes good or evil. They don't care whether we are happy or unhappy. We're just means to an end for them. The only thing they think about is what is most efficient for them. Haruki Murakami, 1Q84. Prologue. Families. The blood of your parents is not lost in you. Menelaus, The Odyssey. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had, and add some extra just for you. Philip Larkin, This Be the Verse. In the winter of 2012, I traveled from Delhi to Calcutta to visit my cousin Moni. My father accompanied me as a guide and companion, but he was a sullen and brooding presence, lost in a private anguish that I could sense only dimly. My father is the youngest of five brothers, and Moni is his firstborn nephew, the eldest brother's son. Since 2004, when he was 40, Moni has been confined to an institution for the mentally ill, a lunatic home, as my father calls it, with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He is kept densely medicated, awash in a sea of assorted antipsychotics and sedatives, and has an attendant watch, bathe, and feed him through the day. My father has never accepted Moni's diagnosis. Over the years, he has waged a lonely counter-campaign against the psychiatrist charged with his nephew's care, hoping to convince them that their diagnosis was a colossal error, or that Moni's broken psyche would somehow magically mend itself. My father has visited the institution in Calcutta twice, once without warning, hoping to see a transformed Moni living a secretly normal life behind the barred gates. But my father knew, and I knew, that there was more than just avuncular love at stake for him in these visits. Moni is not the only member of my father's family with mental illness. Of my father's four brothers, two, not Moni's father, but two of Moni's uncles, suffered from various unravelings of the mind. Madness, it turns out, has been among the Mukherjees for at least two generations, and at least part of my father's reluctance to accept Moni's diagnosis lies in my father's grim recognition that some kernel of the illness may be buried like toxic waste in himself. In 1946, Rajesh, my father's third-born brother, died prematurely in Calcutta. He was 22 years old. The story runs that he was stricken with pneumonia after spending two nights exercising in the winter rain, but the pneumonia was the culmination of another sickness. Rajesh had once been the most promising of the brothers, the nimblest, the supplest, the most charismatic, the most energetic, the most beloved and idolized by my father and his family. My grandfather had died a decade earlier in 1936. He had been murdered following a dispute over mica mines, leaving my grandmother to raise five young boys. Although not the oldest, Rajesh had stepped rather effortlessly into his father's shoes. He was only 12 then, but he could have been 22. His quick-fire intelligence was already being cooled by gravity, the brittle self-assuredness of adolescence already annealing into the self-confidence of adulthood. But in the summer of 46, my father recalls, Rajesh had begun to behave oddly, as if a wire had been tripped in his brain. The most striking change in his personality was his volatility. Good news triggered uncontained outbursts of joy, often extinguished only through increasingly acrobatic bouts of physical exercise, while bad news plunged him into inconsolable desolation. The emotions were normal in context. It was their extreme range that was abnormal. By the winter of that year, the sine curve of Rajesh's psyche had tightened in its frequency and gained in its amplitude. The fits of energy tipping into rage and grandiosity came often and more fiercely, and the sweeping undertow of grief that followed was just as strong. He ventured into the occult, organizing seances and planchette sessions at home, or meeting his friends to meditate at a crematorium at night. I don't know if he self-medicated. In the 40s, the dens in Calcutta's Chinatown had ample supplies of opium from Burma and Afghani hashish to calm a young man's nerves, but my father recollects an altered brother. Fearful at times, reckless at others, descending and ascending steep slopes of mood, irritable one morning and overjoyed the next. That word, overjoyed, used colloquially, it signals something innocent, an amplification of joy. But it also delineates a limit, a warning, an outer boundary of sobriety. Beyond overjoy, as we shall see, there is no overjoy. There is only madness and mania. The week before the pneumonia, Rajesh had received news of a strikingly successful performance in his college exams, and, elated, had vanished on a two-night excursion, supposedly exercising at a wrestling camp. When he returned, he was boiling up with a fever and hallucinating. It was only years later in medical school that I realized that Rajesh was likely in the throes of an acute manic phase. His mental breakdown was the result of a near-textbook case of manic depression, bipolar disease. Jagu, the fourth-born of my father's siblings, came to live with us in Delhi in 1975, when I was 5 years old. His mind was also crumbling. Tall and rail-thin, with a slightly feral look in his eyes and a shock of matted, overgrown hair, he resembled a Bengali Jim Morrison. Unlike Rajesh, whose illness had surfaced in his 20s, Jagu had been troubled from childhood. Socially awkward, withdrawn to everyone except my grandmother, he was unable to hold a job or live by himself. By 1975, deeper cognitive problems had emerged. He had visions, phantasms, and voices in his head that told him what to do. He made up conspiracy theories by the dozens. A banana vendor who sold fruit outside our house was secretly recording Jagu's behavior. He often spoke to himself with a particular obsession of reciting made-up train schedules. He was still capable of extraordinary bursts of tenderness. When I mistakenly smashed a beloved Venetian vase at home, he hid me in his bedclothes and informed my mother that he had mounds of cash stashed away that would buy 1,000 vases in replacement. But this episode was symptomatic. Even his love for me involved extending the fabric of his psychosis and confabulation. Unlike Rajesh, who was never formally diagnosed, Jagu was. In the late 1970s, a physician saw him in Delhi and diagnosed him with schizophrenia. But no medicines were prescribed. Instead, Jagu continued to live at home, half hidden away in my grandmother's room. As in many families in India, my grandmother lived with us. My grandmother, besieged yet again and now with doubled ferocity, assumed the role of public defender for Jagu. For nearly a decade, she and my father held a fragile truce between them, with Jagu living under her care, eating meals in her room and wearing clothes that she stitched for him. At night, when Jagu was particularly restless, consumed by his fears and fantasies, she put him to bed like a child with her hand on his forehead. When she died in 1985, he vanished from our house and could not be persuaded to return. He lived with a religious sect in Delhi until his death in 1998. Both my father and my grandmother believed that Jagu's and Rajesh's mental illnesses had been precipitated, even caused, perhaps, by the apocalypse of partition, its political trauma sublimated into their psychic trauma. Partition, they knew, had split apart not just nations, but also minds. In Sadat Hasan Manto's Toba Tek Singh, arguably the best-known short story of partition, the hero, a lunatic caught on the border between India and Pakistan, also inhabits a limbo between sanity and insanity. In Jagu's and Rajesh's case, my grandmother believed, the upheaval and uprooting from East Bengal to Calcutta had unmoored their minds, although in spectacularly opposite ways. Rajesh had arrived in Calcutta in 1946, just as the city was itself losing sanity. its nerves fraying, its love depleted, its patience spent. A steady flow of men and women from East Bengal, those who had sensed the early political convulsions before their neighbors, had already started to fill the low-rises and tenements near Salada Station. My grandmother was a part of this hardscrabble crowd. She had rented a 3-room flat on Hyatt Khan Lane, just a short walk from the station. The rent was 55 rupees a month, about a dollar in today's terms, but a colossal fortune for her family. The rooms, piled above each other like roughhousing siblings, faced a trash heap. But the flat, albeit minuscule, had windows and a shared roof from which the boys could watch a new city and a new nation being born. Riots were conceived easily on street corners. In August that year, a particularly ugly conflagration between Hindus and Muslims, later labeled the Great Calcutta Killing, resulted in the slaughtering of 5,000 and left 100,000 evicted from their homes. Rajesh had witnessed those rioting mobs in their tidal spate that summer. Hindus had dragged Muslims out of shops and offices in La Bajar and gutted them alive on the streets, while Muslims had reciprocated with equal and opposite ferocity in the fish markets near Raja Bajar and Harrison Road. Rajesh's mental breakdown had followed quickly on the heels of the riots. The city had stabilized and healed, but he had been left permanently scarred. Soon after the August massacres, he was hit by a volley of paranoid hallucinations. He grew increasingly fearful. The evening excursions to the gym became more frequent. Then came the manic convulsions, the spectral fevers, and the sudden cataclysm of his final illness. If Rajesh's madness was the madness of arrival, then Jaggu's madness, my grandmother was convinced, was the madness of departure. In his ancestral village of Dergoti, near Barishal, Jaggu's psyche had somehow been tethered to his friends and his family. Running wild in the paddy fields or swimming in the puddles, he could appear as carefree and playful as any of the other kids, almost normal. In Calcutta, like a plant uprooted from its natural habitat, Jaggu wilted and fell apart. He dropped out of college and parked himself permanently by one of the windows of the flat, looking blankly out at the world. His thoughts began to tangle, and his speech became incoherent. As Rajesh's mind was expanding to its brittle extreme, Jaggu's contracted silently in his room. While Rajesh wandered the city at night, Jaggu could find himself voluntarily at home. The strange taxonomy of mental illness, Rajesh as the town mouse and Jaggu as the country mouse of psychic breakdown, was convenient while it lasted, but it shattered, finally, when Moni's mind also began to fail. Moni, of course, was not a partition child. He had never been uprooted. He had lived all his life in a secure home in Calcutta. Yet, uncannily, the trajectory of his psyche had begun to recapitulate Jaggu's. Visions and voices had started to appear in his adolescence. The need for isolation, the grandiosity of the confabulations, the disorientation and confusion, these were all eerily reminiscent of his uncle's descent. In his teens, he had come to visit us in Delhi. We were supposed to go out to a film together, but he locked himself in our bathroom upstairs and refused to come out for nearly an hour until my grandmother had ferreted him out. When she had found him inside, he was folded over in a corner, hiding. In 2004, Moni was beaten up by a group of goons, allegedly for urinating in a public garden. He told me that an internal voice had commanded him, "Piss here, piss here." A few weeks later, he committed a crime that was so comically egregious that it could only be a testament to his loss of sanity. He was caught flirting with one of the goon sisters. Again, he said that the voices had commanded him to act. His father tried ineffectually to intervene, but this time Moni was beaten up viciously, with a gashed lip and a wound in his forehead that precipitated a visit to the hospital. The beating was meant to be cathartic. Asked by the police, his tormentors later insisted that they had only meant to drive the demons out of Moni. But the pathological commanders in Moni's head only became bolder and more insistent. In the winter of that year, after yet another breakdown with hallucinations and hissing internal voices, he was institutionalized. The confinement, as Moni told me, was partially voluntary. He was not seeking mental rehabilitation as much as a physical sanctuary. An assortment of antipsychotic medicines was prescribed, and he improved gradually, but never enough, apparently, to merit discharge. A few months later, with Moni still confined at the institution, his father died. His mother had already passed away years earlier, and his sister, his only other sibling, lived far away. Moni thus decided to remain in the institution, in part because he had nowhere else to go. Psychiatrists discouraged the use of the archaic phrase, mental asylum, but for Moni, the description had come to be chillingly accurate. This was the one place that offered him the shelter and safety that had been missing from his life. He was a bird that had voluntarily caged itself. When my father and I visited him in 2012, I had not seen Moni for nearly 2 decades. Even so, I had expected to recognize him. But the person I met in the visiting room bore such little resemblance to my memory of my cousin that, had his attendant not confirmed the name, I could easily have been meeting a stranger. He had aged beyond his years. At 48, he looked a decade older. The schizophrenia medicines had altered his body, and he walked with the uncertainty and imbalance of a child. His speech, once effusive and rapid, was hesitant and fitful. The words emerged with a sudden, surprising force, as if he were spitting out strange pips of food that had been put into his mouth. He had little memory of my father or me. When I mentioned my sister's name, he asked me if I had married her. Our conversation proceeded as if I were a newspaper reporter who had dropped out of the blue to interview him. The most striking feature of his illness, though, was not the storm within his mind, but the lull in his eyes. The word Moni means gem in Bengali, but in common usage it also refers to something ineffably beautiful, the shining pinpricks of light in each eye. But this precisely was what had gone missing in Moni. The twin points of light in his eyes had dulled and nearly vanished, as if someone had entered his eyes with a minute paintbrush and painted them gray. Throughout my childhood and adult life, Moni, Jagu, and Rajesh played an outsized role in my family's imagination. During a 6-month flirtation with teenage angst, I stopped speaking to my parents, refused to turn in homework, and threw my old books in the trash. Anxious beyond words, my father dragged me glumly to see the doctor who had diagnosed Jagu. Was his son now losing his mind? As my grandmother's memory failed in the early 80s, she began to call me Rajeshwar. Rajesh, by mistake. She would correct herself at first in the hot blush of embarrassment, but as she broke her final bonds with reality, she seemed to make the mistake almost willingly, as if she had discovered the illicit pleasure of that fantasy. When I met Sarah, now my wife, for the 4th or 5th time, I told her about the splintered minds of my cousin and 2 uncles. It was only fair to a future partner that I should come with a letter of warning. By then, heredity, illness, normalcy, family, and identity had become recurrent themes of conversation in my family. Like most Bengalis, my parents had elevated repression and denial to a high art form, but even so, questions about this particular history were unavoidable. Moni, Rajesh, Jagu, 3 lives consumed by variants of mental illness. It was hard not to imagine that a hereditary component lurked behind this family history. Had Moni inherited a gene, or a set of genes, that had made him susceptible, the same genes that had affected our uncles? Had others been affected with different variants of mental illness? My father had had at least 2 psychotic fugues in his life, both precipitated by the consumption of bhang, mashed up cannabis buds melted in ghee and churned into a frothing drink for religious festivals. Were these related to the same scar of history? In 2009, Swedish researchers published an enormous international study involving thousands of families and tens of thousands of men and women. By analyzing families that possessed intergenerational histories of mental illness, the study found striking evidence that bipolar disease and schizophrenia shared a strong genetic link. Some of the families described in the study possessed a crisscrossing history of mental illness achingly similar to my own. 1 sibling affected with schizophrenia, another with bipolar disease, and a nephew or niece who was also schizophrenic. In 2012, several further studies corroborated these initial findings, strengthening the links between these variants of mental illness and family histories and deepening questions about their ideology, epidemiology, triggers, and instigators. I read two of these studies on a winter morning on the subway in New York, a few months after returning from Calcutta. Across the aisle, a man in a gray fur hat was pinning down his son to put a gray fur hat on him. At 59th Street, a mother wheeled in a stroller with twins emitting, it seemed to my ears, identically pitched screams. The study provided a strange interior solace, answering some of the questions that had so haunted my father and grandmother. But it also provoked a volley of new questions. If Moni's illness was genetic, then why had his father and sister been spared? What triggers had unveiled these predispositions? How much of Jagu's or Moni's illnesses arose from nature, that is, genes that predispose to mental illness, versus nurture, environmental triggers such as upheaval, discord, and trauma? Might my father carry the susceptibility? Was I a carrier as well? What if I could know the precise nature of this genetic flaw? Would I test myself or my two daughters? Would I inform them of the results? What if only one of them turned out to carry that mark? While my family's history of mental illness was cutting through my consciousness like a red line, my scientific work as a cancer biologist was also converging on the normalcy and abnormalcy of genes. Cancer, perhaps, is an ultimate perversion of genetics, a genome that becomes pathologically obsessed with replicating itself. The genome as self-replicating machine co-opts the physiology of a cell, resulting in a shape-shifting illness that, despite significant advances, still defies our ability to treat or cure it. But to study cancer, I realized, is to also study its obverse. What is the code of normalcy before it becomes corrupted by cancer's coda? What does the normal genome do? How does it maintain the constancy that makes us discernibly similar, and the variation that makes us discernibly different? How, for that matter, is constancy versus variation, or normalcy versus abnormalcy, defined or written into the genome? And what if we learned to change our genetic code intentionally? If such technologies were available, who would control them? And who would ensure their safety? Who would be the masters and who the victims of this technology? How would the acquisition and control of this knowledge and its inevitable invasion of our private and public lives alter the way we imagine our societies, our children, and ourselves? This book is the story of the birth, growth, and future of one of the most powerful and dangerous ideas in the history of science, the gene, the fundamental unit of heredity, and the basic unit of all biological information. I use that last adjective, dangerous, with full cognizance. Three profoundly destabilizing scientific ideas ricochet through the 20th century, trisecting it into three unequal parts, the atom, the bite, the gene. Each is foreshadowed by an earlier century, but dazzles into full prominence in the 20th. Each begins its life as a rather abstract scientific concept, but grows to invade multiple human discourses, thereby transforming culture, society, politics, and language. But the most crucial parallel between the three ideas, by far, is conceptual. Each represents the irreducible unit, the building block, the basic organizational unit of a larger whole. The atom of matter, the byte or bit of digitized information, the gene of heredity and biological information. Why does this property, being the least divisible unit of a larger form, imbue these particular ideas with such potency and force? The simple answer is that matter, information, and biology are inherently hierarchically organized. Understanding the smallest part is crucial to understanding the whole. When the poet Wallace Stevens writes, "In the sum of the parts, there are only the parts," he's referring to the deep structural mystery that runs through language. You can only decipher the meaning of a sentence by deciphering every individual word. Yet a sentence carries more meaning than any of the individual words. And so it is with genes. An organism is much more than its genes, of course, but to understand an organism, you must first understand its genes. When the Dutch biologist Hugo de Vries encountered the concept of the gene in the 1890s, he quickly intuited that the idea would reorganize our understanding of the natural world. The whole organic world is the result of innumerable different combinations and permutations of relatively few factors. Just as physics and chemistry go back to molecules and atoms, the biological sciences have to penetrate these units, genes, in order to explain the phenomena of the living world. The atom, the bite, and the gene provide fundamentally new scientific and technological understandings of their respective systems. You cannot explain the behavior of matter, why gold gleams, why hydrogen combusts with oxygen, without invoking the atomic nature of matter. Nor can you understand the complexities of computing, the nature of algorithms, or the storage or corruption of data, without comprehending the structural anatomy of digitized information. Alchemy could not become chemistry until its fundamental units were discovered, a 19th century scientist wrote. By the same token, as I argue in this book, it is impossible to understand organismal and cellular biology or evolution or human pathology, behavior, temperament, illness, race, and identity or fate without first reckoning with the concept of the gene. There is a second issue at stake here. Understanding atomic science was a necessary precursor to manipulating matter and, via the manipulation of matter, to the invention of the atomic bomb. Our understanding of genes has allowed us to manipulate organisms with unparalleled dexterity and power. The actual nature of the genetic code, it turns out, is astoundingly simple. There's just one molecule that carries our hereditary information and just one code. That the fundamental aspects of heredity should have turned out to be so extraordinarily simple supports us in the hope that nature may, after all, be entirely approachable, Thomas Morgan, the influential geneticist, wrote. Her much-advertised inscrutability has once more been found to be an illusion. Our understanding of genes has reached such a level of sophistication and depth that we are no longer studying and altering genes in test tubes, but in their native context in human cells. Genes reside on chromosomes, long filamentous structures buried within cells that contain tens of thousands of genes linked together in chains. Humans have 46 such chromosomes in total, 23 from one parent and 23 from another. The entire set of genetic instructions carried by an organism is termed a genome. Think of the genome as the encyclopedia of all genes with footnotes, annotations, instructions, and references. The human genome contains about between 21 and 23,000 genes that provide the master instructions to build, repair, and maintain humans. Over the last two decades, genetic technologies have advanced so rapidly that we can decipher how several of these genes operate in time and space to enable these complex functions. And we can, on occasion, deliberately alter some of these genes to change their functions, thereby resulting in altered human states, altered physiologies, and changed beings. This transition from explanation to manipulation is precisely what makes the field of genetics resonate far beyond the realms of science. It's one thing to try to understand how genes influence human identity or sexuality or temperament. It is quite another thing to imagine altering identity or sexuality or behavior by altering genes. The former thought might preoccupy professors in departments of psychology and their colleagues in the neighboring departments of neuroscience. The latter thought, inflected with both promise and peril, should concern us all. As I write this, organisms endowed with genomes are learning to change the heritable features of organisms endowed with genomes. I mean the following. In just the last 4 years, between 2012 and 2016, we have invented technologies that allow us to change human genomes intentionally and permanently. Although the safety and fidelity of these genomic engineering technologies still need to be carefully evaluated. At the same time, the capacity to predict the future fate of an individual from his or her genome has advanced dramatically, although the true predictive capacities of these technologies still remain unknown. We can now read human genomes and we can write human genomes in a manner inconceivable just 3 or 4 years ago. It hardly requires an advanced degree in molecular biology, philosophy, or history to note that the convergence of these two events is like a headlong sprint into an abyss. Once we can understand the nature of fate encoded by individual genomes, even if we can predict this in likelihoods rather than in certainties, and once we acquire the technology to intentionally change these likelihoods, even if these technologies are inefficient and cumbersome, our future is fundamentally changed. George Orwell once wrote that whenever a critic uses the word human, he usually renders it meaningless. I doubt that I am overstating the case here. Our capacity to understand and manipulate human genomes alters our conception of what it means to be human. The atom provides an organizing principle for modern physics, and it tantalizes us with the prospect of controlling matter and energy. The gene provides an organizing principle for modern biology, and it tantalizes us with the prospect of controlling our bodies and fates. Embedded in the history of the gene is the quest for eternal youth, the Faustian myth of abrupt reversal of fortune, and our own century's flirtation with the perfectibility of man. Embedded equally is the desire to decipher our manual of instructions. That is what is at the center of this story. This audiobook is organized both chronologically and thematically. The overall arc is historical. We begin in Mendel's pea flower garden in an obscure Moravian monastery in 1864, where the gene is discovered and then quickly forgotten. The word gene only appears decades later. The story intersects with Darwin's theory of evolution. The gene entrances English and American reformers who hope to manipulate human genetics to accelerate human evolution and emancipation. That idea escalates to its macabre zenith in Nazi Germany in the 1940s, where human eugenics is used to justify grotesque experiments, culminating in confinement, sterilization, euthanasia, and mass murder. A chain of post-World War II discoveries launches a revolution in biology. DNA is identified as the source of genetic information. The action of a gene is described in mechanistic terms. Genes encode chemical messages to build proteins that ultimately enable form and function. James Watson, Francis Crick, Morris Wilkins, and Rosalind Franklin solved the three-dimensional structure of DNA, producing the iconic image of the double helix. The three-letter genetic code is deciphered. Two technologies transformed genetics in the 1970s, gene sequencing and gene cloning, the reading and writing of genes. The phrase gene cloning encompasses the gamut of techniques used to extract genes from organisms, manipulate them in test tubes, create gene hybrids, and produce millions of copies of such hybrids in living cells. In the 1980s, human geneticists begin to use these techniques to map and identify genes linked to diseases, such as Huntington's disease and cystic fibrosis. The identification of these disease-linked genes augurs a new era of genetic management, enabling parents to screen fetuses and potentially abort them if they carry deleterious mutations. Any person who has tested their unborn child for Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis, or Tay-Sachs disease, or has been tested herself for, say, BRCA1 or BRCA2, has already entered this era of genetic diagnosis, management, and optimization. This is not a story of our distant future. It is already embedded in our present. Multiple genetic mutations are identified in human cancers, leading to a deeper genetic understanding of that disease. These efforts reach their crescendo in the Human Genome Project, an international project to map and sequence the entire human genome. The draft sequence of the human genome is published in 2001. The Genome Project, in turn, inspires attempts to understand human variation and normal behavior in terms of genes. The gene, meanwhile, invades discourses concerning race, racial discrimination, and racial intelligence, and provides startling answers to some of the most potent questions coursing through our political and cultural realms. It reorganizes our understanding of sexuality, identity, and choice, thus piercing the center of some of the most urgent questions coursing through our personal realms. There are stories within each of these stories, but this book is also a very personal story, an intimate history. The weight of heredity is not an abstraction for me. Rajesh and Jagu are dead. Moni is confined to a mental institution in Calcutta, but their lives and deaths have had a greater impact on my thinking as a scientist, scholar, historian, physician, son, and father than I could possibly have envisioned. Scarcely a day passes in my adult life when I do not think about inheritance and family. Most important, I owe a debt to my grandmother. She could not outlive the grief of her inheritance, but she embraced and defended the most fragile of her children from the will of the strong. She weathered the buffets of history with resilience, but she weathered the buffets of heredity with something more than resilience, a grace that we, as her descendants, can only hope to emulate. It is to her that this book is dedicated. Part 1. The Missing Science of Heredity. The Discovery and Rediscovery of Genes, 1865 to 1935. The Missing Science of Heredity, this unworked mine of knowledge on the borderland of biology and anthropology, which for all practical purposes is as unworked now as it was in the days of Plato, is, in simple truth, 10 times more important to humanity than all the chemistry and physics, all the technical and industrial science that ever has been or ever will be discovered. Herbert G. Wells, Mankind in the Making. The Walled Garden. The monastery was originally a nunnery. The monks of St. Augustine's order had once lived, as they often liked to grouse, in more lavish circumstances in the ample rooms of a large stone abbey on the top of a hill in the heart of the medieval city of Brno, Brno in Czech, Brun in German. The city had grown around them over 4 centuries, cascading down the slopes and then sprawling out over the flat landscape of farms and meadowlands below. But the friars had fallen out of favor with Emperor Joseph II in 1783. The midtown real estate was far too valuable to house them, the emperor had decreed bluntly, and the monks were packed off to a crumbling structure at the bottom of the hill in Old Brno. The ignominy of the relocation compounded by the fact that they had been assigned to live in quarters originally designed for women. The halls had the vague animal smell of damp mortar, and the grounds were overgrown with grass, bramble, and weeds. The only perk of this 14th-century building, as cold as a meat house and as bare as a prison, was a rectangular garden with shade trees, stone steps, and a long alley where the monks could walk and think in isolation. The friars made the best of the new accommodations. A library was restored on the second floor. A study room was connected to it and outfitted with pine reading desks, a few lamps, and a growing collection of nearly 10,000 books, including the latest works of natural history, geology, and astronomy. The Augustinians, fortunately, saw no conflict between religion and most science. Indeed, they embraced science as yet another testament of the workings of the divine order in the world. A wine cellar was carved out below, and a modest refectory vaulted above it. One-room cells, with the most rudimentary wooden furniture, housed the inhabitants on the second floor. In October 1843, a young man from Silesia, the son of 2 peasants, joined the abbey. He was a short man with a serious face, myopic, and tending toward portliness. He professed little interest in the spiritual life, but was intellectually curious, good with his hands, and a natural gardener. The monastery provided him with a home and a place to read and learn. He was ordained on August 6, 1847. His given name was Johann, but the friars changed it to Gregor Johann Mendel. For the young priest in training, life at the monastery soon settled into a predictable routine. In 1845, as part of his monastic education, Mendel attended classes in theology, history, and natural sciences at Brno's Theological College. The tumult of 1848, the bloody populist revolutions that swept fiercely through France, Denmark, Germany, and Austria, and overturned social, political, and religious orders, largely passed him by like distant thunder. Nothing about Mendel's early years suggested even the faintest glimmer of the revolutionary scientist who would later emerge. He was disciplined, plodding, deferential, a man of habits among men in habits. His only challenge to authority, it seemed, was his occasional refusal to wear the scholar's cap to class. Admonished by his superiors, he politely complied. In the summer of 1848, Mendel began work as a parish priest in Brno. He was, by all accounts, terrible at the job. Seized by an unconquerable timidity, as the abbot described it, Mendel was tongue-tied in Czech, the language of most parishioners, uninspiring as a priest and too neurotic to bear the emotional brunt of the work among the poor. Later that year, he schemed a perfect way out. He applied for a job to teach mathematics, natural sciences, and elementary Greek at the Zenaim High School. With a helpful nudge from the Abbey, Mendel was selected. Although there was a catch. Knowing that he had never been trained as a teacher, the school asked Mendel to sit for the formal examination in the natural sciences for high school teachers. In the late spring of 1850, an eager Mendel took the written version of the exam in Brno. He failed, with a particularly abysmal performance in geology. "Arid, obscure, and hazy," one reviewer complained of Mendel's writing on the subject. On July 20th, in the midst of an enervating heat wave in Austria, he traveled from Brno to Vienna to take the oral part of the exam. On August 16th, he appeared before his examiners to be tested in the natural sciences. This time, his performance was even worse, in biology. Asked to describe and classify mammals, he scribbled down an incomplete and absurd system of taxonomy, omitting categories, inventing others, lumping kangaroos with beavers and pigs with elephants. "The candidate seems to know nothing about technical terminology, naming all animals in colloquial German and avoiding systematic nomenclature," one of the examiners wrote. Mendel failed again. In August, Mendel returned to Brno with his exam results. The verdict from the examiners had been clear. If Mendel was to be allowed to teach, he needed additional education in the natural sciences, more advanced training than the monastery library or its walled garden could provide. Mendel applied to the University of Vienna to pursue a degree in the natural sciences. The Abbey intervened with letters and pleas. Mendel was accepted. In the winter of 1851, Mendel boarded the train to enroll in his classes at the university. It was here that Mendel's problems with biology and biology's problems with Mendel would begin. The night train from Brno to Vienna slices through a spectacularly bleak landscape in the winter. The farmlands and vineyards buried in frost, the canals hardened into ice-blue venules, the occasional farmhouse blanketed in the locked darkness of Central Europe. The river Tyja crosses the land, half-frozen and sluggish. The islands of the Danube come into view. It is a distance of only 90 miles, a journey of about 4 hours in Mendel's time. But the morning of his arrival, it was as if Mendel had woken up in a new cosmos. In Vienna, science was crackling, electric, alive. At the university, just a few miles from his back-alley boarding house on Invalidenstrasse, Mendel began to experience the intellectual baptism that he had so ardently sought in Brno. Physics was taught by Christian Doppler, the redoubtable Austrian scientist who would become Mendel's mentor, teacher, and idol. In 1842, Doppler, a gaunt acerbic 39-year-old, had used mathematical reasoning to argue that the pitch of sound, or the color of light, was not fixed, but depended on the location and velocity of the observer. Sound from a source speeding toward a listener would become compressed and register at a higher pitch, while sound speeding away would be heard with a drop in its pitch. Skeptics had scoffed. How could the same light emitted from the same lamp be registered as different colors by different viewers? But in 1845, Doppler had loaded a train with a band of trumpet players and asked them to hold a note as the train sped forward. As the audience on the platform listened in disbelief, a higher note came from the train as it approached, and a lower note emanated as it sped away. Sound and light, Doppler argued, behaved according to universal and natural laws, even if these were deeply counterintuitive to ordinary viewers or listeners. Indeed, if you look carefully, all the chaotic and complex phenomena of the world were the result of highly organized natural laws. Occasionally, our intuitions and perceptions might allow us to grasp these natural laws, but more commonly, a profoundly artificial experiment, floating trumpeters on a speeding train, might be necessary to understand and demonstrate these laws. Doppler's demonstrations and experiments captivated Mendel as much as they frustrated him. Biology, his main subject, seemed to be a wild, overgrown garden of a discipline, lacking any systematic organizing principles. Superficially, there seemed to be a profusion of order, or rather a profusion of orders. The reigning discipline in biology was taxonomy, an elaborate attempt to classify and subclassify all living things into distinct categories, kingdoms, phyla, classes, orders, families, genera, and species, But these categories, originally devised by the Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus in the mid-1700s, were purely descriptive, not mechanistic. The system described how to categorize living things on the earth, but did not ascribe an underlying logic to its organization. Why, a biologist might ask, were living things categorized in this manner? What maintained its constancy or fidelity? What kept elephants from morphing into pigs or kangaroos into beavers? What was the mechanism of heredity? Why or how did like beget like? The question of likeness had preoccupied scientists and philosophers for centuries. Pythagoras, the Greek scholar, half-scientist, half-mystic, who lived in Croton around 530 BC, proposed one of the earliest and most widely accepted theories to explain the similarity between parents and their children. The core of Pythagoras's theory was that hereditary information, likeness, was principally carried in male semen. Semen collected these instructions by coursing through a man's body and absorbing mystical vapors from each of the individual parts. The eyes contributed their color, the skin its texture, the bones their length, and so forth. Over a man's life, his semen grew into a mobile library of every part of the body, a condensed distillate of the self. This self-information, seminal in the most literal sense, was transmitted into a female body during intercourse. Once inside the womb, semen matured into a fetus via nourishment from the mother. In reproduction, as in any form of production, men's work and women's work were clearly partitioned, Pythagoras argued. The father provided the essential information to create a fetus. The mother's womb provided nutrition so that this data could be transformed into a child. The theory was eventually called spermism, highlighting the central role of the sperm in determining all the features of a fetus. In 458 BC, a few decades after Pythagoras' death, the playwright Aeschylus used this odd logic to provide one of history's most extraordinary legal defenses of matricide. The central theme of Aeschylus' Eumenides is the trial of Orestes, the prince of Argos, for the murder of his mother, Clytemnestra. In most cultures, matricide was perceived as an ultimate act of moral perversion. In Eumenides, Apollo, chosen to represent Orestes in his murder trial, mounts a strikingly original argument. He reasons that Orestes' mother is no more than a stranger to him. A pregnant woman is just a glorified human incubator, Apollo argues, an intravenous bag dripping nutrients through the umbilical cord into her child. The true forebearer of all humans is the father, whose sperm carries likeness. Not the true parent is the woman's womb that bears the child, Apollo tells his sympathetic council of jurors. She doth but nurse the seed, new sown. The male is parent. She for him, as stranger for a stranger, just hoards the germ of life. The evident asymmetry of this theory of inheritance, the male supplying all the nature and the female providing the initial nurture in her womb, didn't seem to bother Pythagoras's followers. Indeed, they may have found it rather pleasing. Pythagoreans were obsessed with the mystical geometry of triangles. Pythagoras had learned the triangle theorem, that the length of the third side of a right-angled triangle can be deduced mathematically from the length of the other two sides, from Indian or Babylonian geometers. But the theorem became inextricably attached to his name, henceforth called the Pythagorean theorem, and his students offered it as proof that such secret mathematical patterns, harmonies, were lurking everywhere in nature. Straining to see the world through triangle-shaped lenses, Pythagoreans argued that in heredity, too, a triangular harmony was at work. The mother and the father were two independent sides, and the child was the third, the biological hypotenuse to the parents' two lines. And just as a triangle's third side could arithmetically be derived from the two other sides using a strict mathematical formula, so was a child derived from the parents' individual contributions, nature from father and nurture from mother. A century after Pythagoras' death, Plato, writing in 380 BC, was captivated by this metaphor. In one of the most intriguing passages in The Republic, borrowed in part from Pythagoras, Plato argued that if children were the arithmetic derivatives of their parents, then, at least in principle, the formula could be hacked. Perfect children could be derived from perfect combinations of parents breeding at perfectly calibrated times. A theorem of heredity existed. It was merely waiting to be known.
By unlocking the theorem and then enforcing its prescriptive combinations, any society could guarantee the production of the fittest children, unleashing a sort of numerological eugenics. For when your guardians are ignorant of the law of births and unite bride and bridegroom out of season, the children will not be goodly or fortunate, Plato concluded. The guardians of his republic, its elite ruling class, having deciphered the law of births, would ensure that only such harmonious fortunate unions would occur in the future. A political utopia would develop as a consequence of genetic utopia. It took a mind as precise and analytical as Aristotle's to systematically dismantle Pythagoras' theory of heredity. Aristotle was not a particularly ardent champion of women, but he nevertheless believed in using evidence as the basis of theory building. He set about dissecting the merits and problems of spermism using experimental data from the biological world. The result, a compact treatise titled Generation of Animals, would serve as a foundational text for human genetics, just as Plato's Republic was a founding text for political philosophy. Aristotle rejected the notion that heredity was carried exclusively in male semen or sperm. He noted astutely that children can inherit features from their mothers and grandmothers, just as they inherit features from their fathers and grandfathers, and that these features can even skip generations, disappearing for one generation and reappearing in the next. And from deformed parents, deformed offspring comes to be, he wrote, just as lame come to be from lame and blind from blind, and in general they resemble often the features that are against nature and have inborn signs such as growths and scars. Some of such features have been transmitted through three generations. For instance, someone who had a mark on his arm and his son was born without it, but his grandson had black in the same place, but in a blurred way. In Sicily, a woman committed adultery with a man from Ethiopia. The daughter did not become an Ethiopian, but her granddaughter did. A grandson could be born with his grandmother's nose or her skin color, without that feature being visible in either parent, a phenomenon virtually impossible to explain in terms of Pythagoras' scheme of purely patrilineal heredity. Aristotle challenged Pythagoras' traveling library notion that semen collected hereditary information by coursing through the body and obtaining secret instructions from each individual part. Men generate before they yet have certain characters, such as a beard or gray hair, Aristotle wrote perceptively, but they pass on those features to their children. Occasionally, the feature transmitted through heredity was not even corporeal, a manner of walking, say, or a way of staring into space, or even a state of mind. Aristotle argued that such traits, not material to start with, could not materialize into semen. And finally, and perhaps more obviously, he attacked Pythagoras' scheme with the most self-evident of arguments. It could not possibly account for female anatomy. How could a father's sperm absorb the instructions to produce his daughter's generative parts, Aristotle asked, when none of these parts was to be found anywhere in the father's body? Pythagoras' theory could explain every aspect of Genesis except the most crucial one, genitals. Aristotle offered an alternative theory that was strikingly radical for its time. Perhaps females, like males, contribute actual material to the fetus, a form of female semen. And perhaps the fetus is formed by the mutual contributions of male and female parts. Grasping for analogies, Aristotle called the male contribution a principle of movement. Movement, here, was not literally motion, but instruction or information, code, to use a modern formulation. The actual material exchange during intercourse was merely a stand-in for a more obscure and mysterious exchange. Matter, in fact, didn't really matter. What passed from man to woman was not matter, but message. Like an architectural plan for a building, or like a carpenter's handiwork to a piece of wood, male semen carried the instructions to build a child. Just as no material part comes from the carpenter to the wood in which he works, Aristotle wrote, but the shape and the form are imparted from him to the material by means of the motion he sets up. In like manner, nature uses the semen as a tool. Female semen, in contrast, contributed the physical raw material for the fetus, wood for the carpenter or mortar for the building, the stuff and the stuffing of life. Aristotle argued that the actual material provided by females was menstrual blood. Male semen sculpted menstrual blood into the shape of a child. The claim might sound outlandish today, but here, too, Aristotle's meticulous logic was at work. Since the disappearance of menstrual blood is coincident with conception, Aristotle assumed that the fetus must be made from it. Aristotle was wrong in his partitioning of male and female contributions into material and message, but abstractly, he had captured one of the essential truths about the nature of heredity. The transmission of heredity, as Aristotle perceived it, was essentially the transmission of information. Information was then used to build an organism from scratch. Message became material. And when an organism matured, it generated male or female semen again, transforming material back to message. In fact, rather than Pythagoras's triangle, there was a circle or a cycle at work. Form begat information, and then information begat form. Centuries later, the biologist Max Delbruck would joke that Aristotle should have been given the Nobel Prize posthumously for the discovery of DNA. But if heredity was transmitted as information, then how was that information encoded? The word code comes from the Latin codex, the wooden pith of a tree on which scribes carved their writing. What then was the codex of heredity? What was being transcribed and how? How was the material packaged and transported from one body to the next? Who encrypted the code and who translated it to create a child? The most inventive solution to these questions was the simplest. It dispensed of code altogether. Sperm, this theory argued, already contained a mini-human, a tiny fetus fully formed, shrunken and curled into a minuscule package and waiting to be progressively inflated into a baby. Variations of this theory appear in medieval myths and folklore. In the 1520s, the Swiss-German alchemist Paracelsus used the mini-human in sperm theory to suggest that human sperm, heated with horse dung and buried in mud for the 40 weeks of normal conception, would eventually grow into a human, although with some monstrous characteristics. The conception of a normal child was merely the transfer of this mini-human, the homunculus, from the father's sperm into the mother's womb. In the womb, the mini-human was expanded to the size of the fetus. There was no code. There was only miniaturization. The peculiar charm of this idea, called preformation, was that it was infinitely recursive. Since the homunculus had to mature and produce its own children, it had to have preformed mini-homunculi lodged inside it, tiny humans encased inside humans, like an infinite series of Russian dolls, a great chain of beings that stretched all the way backward from the present to the first man, to Adam, and forward into the future. For medieval Christians, the existence of such a chain of humans provided a most powerful and original understanding of original sin. Since all future humans were encased within all humans, each of us had to have been physically present inside Adam's body, floating in our first parent's loins, as one theologian described, during his crucial moment of sin. Sinfulness, therefore, was embedded within us thousands of years before we were born, from Adam's loins directly to his line. All of us bore its taint, not because our distant ancestor had been tempted in that distant garden, but because each of us, lodged in Adam's body, had actually tasted the fruit. The second charm of preformation was that it dispensed of the problem of de-encryption. Even if early biologists could fathom encryption, the conversion of a human body into some sort of code, by osmosis a la Pythagoras, the reverse act, deciphering that code back into a human being, completely boggled the mind. How could something as complex as a human form emerge out of the union of sperm and egg? The homunculus dispensed of this conceptual problem. If a child came already preformed, then its formation was merely an act of expansion, a biological version of a blow-up doll. No key or cipher was required for the deciphering. The genesis of a human being was just a matter of adding water. The theory was so seductive, so artfully vivid, that even the invention of the microscope was unable to deal the expected fatal blow to the homunculus. In 1694, Nicholas Hartzucker, the Dutch physicist and microscopist, conjured a picture of such a mini-being, its enlarged head twisted in fetal position and curled into the head of a sperm. In 1699, another Dutch microscopist claimed to have found homuncular creatures floating abundantly in human sperm. As with any anthropomorphic fantasy, finding human faces on the moon, say, the theory was only magnified by the lenses of imagination. Pictures of homunculi proliferated in the 17th century, with the sperm's tail reconceived into a filament of human hair, or its cellular head visualized as a tiny human skull. By the end of the 17th century, preformation was considered the most logical and consistent explanation for human and animal heredity. Men came from small men, as large trees came from small cuttings. In nature, there is no generation, the Dutch scientist Jan Swammerdam wrote in 1669, but only propagation. But not everyone could be convinced that miniature humans were infinitely encased inside humans. The principal challenge to preformation was the idea that something had to happen during embryogenesis that led to the formation of entirely new parts in the embryo. Humans did not come pre-shrunk and pre-made, awaiting only expansion. They had to be generated from scratch, using specific instructions locked inside the sperm and egg. Limbs, torsos, brains, eyes, faces, even temperaments or propensities that were inherited, had to be created anew each time an embryo unfurled into a human fetus. Genesis happened, well, by Genesis. By what impetus or instruction was the embryo and the final organism generated from sperm and egg? In 1768, the Berlin embryologist Caspar Wolff tried to finesse an answer by concocting a guiding principle, vis essentialis corporis, as he called it, that progressively shepherded the maturation of a fertilized egg into a human form. Like Aristotle, Wolff imagined that the embryo contained some sort of encrypted information, code, that was not merely a miniature version of a human, but instructions to make a human from scratch. But aside from inventing a Latinate name for a vague principle, Wolff could provide no further specifics. The instructions, he argued obliquely, were blended together in the fertilized egg. The vis essentialis then came along, like an invisible hand, and molded the formation of this mass into a human form. While biologists, philosophers, Christian scholars, and embryologists fought their way through vicious debates between preformation and the invisible hand throughout much of the 18th century, a casual observer may have been forgiven for feeling rather unimpressed by it all. This was, after all, stale news. The opposing views of today were in existence centuries ago, a 19th century biologist complained, rightfully. Indeed, preformation was largely a restatement of Pythagoras's theory, that sperm carried all the information to make a new human, and the invisible hand was, in turn, merely a gilded variant of Aristotle's idea, that heredity was carried in the form of messages to create materials. It was the hand that carried the instructions to mold an embryo. In time, both the theories would be spectacularly vindicated and spectacularly demolished. Both Aristotle and Pythagoras were partially right and partially wrong. But in the early 1800s, it seemed as if the entire field of heredity and embryogenesis had reached a conceptual impasse. The world's greatest biological thinkers, having pored over the problem of heredity, had scarcely advanced the field beyond the cryptic musings of two men who had lived on two Greek islands 2,000 years earlier. The Mystery of Mysteries. They mean to tell us all was rolling blind, till accidentally it hit on mind, in an albino monkey in a jungle. And even then it had to grope and bungle, till Darwin came to Earth upon a year. Robert Frost, Accidentally on Purpose. In the winter of 1831, when Mendel was still a schoolboy in Silesia, a young clergyman, Charles Darwin, boarded a 10-gun brig sloop, the HMS Beagle, at Plymouth Sound, on the southwestern shore of England. Darwin was then 22 years old, the son and grandson of prominent physicians. He had the square, handsome face of his father, the porcelain complexion of his mother, and the dense overhang of eyebrows that ran in the Darwin family over generations. He had tried, unsuccessfully, to study medicine at Edinburgh, but horrified by the screams of a strapped-down child amid the blood and sawdust of the operating theater, had fled medicine to study theology at Christ's College in Cambridge.